I'm Sarah Kanoski. Great to have your company on Books and Arts today. Do you think technology is degrading the way we use language? We'll travel to the Emerging Writers Festival in search of answers.
In all cases, it's a recognition of change, which is exciting.
But the emoji is another step into that sort of realm of ambiguity that comes with lol, that comes with haha, that comes with the eggplant emoji.
We'll also meet Simon Armitage, one of the UK's best-loved poets. He's been translating classics from Middle English, and he'll explain the beauty and the relevance of these 600-year-old poems.
In harmonising with voices from the past, I think there's a sense of genealogy, that you're almost tracing ancestors, a feeling of connect with roots and with lineage and with family.
First on Books and Arts, making theatre about the dark side of Australia's mining boom.
I wrote this song after reading about the history of all the places in Australia where asbestos has been mined and manufactured. I could have called it Wittenoom dust, or Latrobe Valley dust, or Ballarat dust. But I chose a little place called Camellia, which is a suburb about 20 k's west of Sydney, right out on the edge of the Parramatta River.
That's Mark Seymour with Camellia Dust, a song from Donna Jackson's show Dust, which she toured around Australia between 2008 and 2013. Donna is a theatre maker who creates big shows dealing with big social issues, and she's now brought out a book called Art and Social Change, Dust, a Case Study. It's part handbook and part a record of this ambitious project. Welcome to Books and Arts, Donna.
Good morning, Sarah.
First of all, tell me about the play that generated the book. How did it start?
The play Dust started, I was doing another play. One play can inspire another. The play was called We Built This City, and I was doing a show with 120 building workers at Science Works.
even that's something that's pause for thought.
That's right, 120 building workers. And I was outside with one of those building workers, and his name's Ron Patton, and we were outside and he was having a cup of tea before the show. And he said, you know, what's wrong with this show? It's not talking about asbestos. And I already had a giant show, and I said, well, I can't include it in this show. What is it about asbestos? He said, look, I've been to six funerals of six friends in 6 months, and wow, Someone has to talk about asbestos. And it was a word coming out of a vortex of the past. And I read a book called Asbestos House by Gideon Haig, and through that I discovered there was a whole lot of people who were trying to get compensation from James Hardy Company for exposure to asbestos, and it was hard for them to get compensation, and also that there was a whole history of this wonder product in Australia that had been used to build outside sheds. And then I remembered that I'd seen asbestos cement sheeting everywhere in boat sheds, and also I remembered my father angle grinding brake pads, and I remembered standing underneath them in the garage as he was angle grinding these brake pads for his truck and being sprayed with white powder, and thought, oh
gosh,
I've been exposed to asbestos too.
It's funny, Donna, because it had become such a big part of our sort of awareness as Australians with Bernie Banton and the compensation claims. But really, you're taking us back to a time before the dangers and the terrible legacy of asbestos is as well known as I think it is now.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that people don't realise, that it's part of Australian history. And after the Second World War, this was a wonder product that enabled people to be able to build cheap housing when they came back after the Second World War, and knock up fibro cement houses and build them themselves. And also, this was a product that was incorporated in the 1960s into Play-Doh. And it was used in toothpaste, and it was also used in mattresses. So it was used across the gamut because it was such a fantastic product that was so versatile. And so the story of it is also about people's, how useful it was and how people loved it, and then slowly people realising by being exposed to one fibre from it, people could become sick and get either asbestosis or mesothelioma. But it took a long time for people to be aware that that's where the illnesses were coming from.
And as a potential, not an automatic thing, obviously, because as you suggest, so many Australians were exposed, are still being exposed to asbestos, but it's not an automatic, doesn't automatically create those illnesses?
No, it doesn't. And it's and so that's what's interesting when I was creating Dust, the play, that I interviewed hundreds of people from the Asbestos Diseases Society of Victoria, now called Asbestos Wise. And they told me stories sometimes about people working in power stations and interviewed guys who worked at power stations for years, but it was their wife who washed their overalls and shook them out who got mesothelioma and not the person who was working at the power station. So some people are more susceptible to exposure to asbestos than others. So you can't no exposure to asbestos is good because it's so dangerous.
That story about the wife washing the overalls, I think that illustrates it's one of the sort of the tragic nature of this story around asbestos is its domesticity. You know, it was it wasn't separated. It wasn't like that, say, miners were exposed to this when they were away at work, maybe off-site somewhere. It really, as you say, it's what people made sheds out of. It's wives washing overalls. So it really it crept into people's lives. But how do you go about, Donna, when there's a story with such far-reaching backstory and such far-reaching implications? How, as a theatre maker, do you start pulling all that in together to make a show?
So in Dust, a Case Study, one of the things I've written some articles about developing the show, and one of the stories I tell is about Ron Patton, the bricklayer, inviting me to an asbestos memorial service, and I went there with Mark Seymour and to see if there was a way of making a show, because I didn't want to make a sad show about cancer that just made people feel depressed, because that's not it's not theatre, and theatre is a form that has to be live and interesting and engaging for an audience, for people to leave their homes and come out at night. You have to make something that excites people. So at the memorial service, we sat there and we went through the memorial service, and Bishop Philip Huggins ran this memorial service at Federation Square. It happens every November. And it was a beautiful piece of theatre, as a memorial service can be. Philip Huggins led people into a place of darkness and sadness to acknowledge the deaths, and then talked about people working together and sort of led us at the end with a song in an uplifting way that we thought, oh, we can create change if we come together. So that was inspiring the memorial service. And then we went outside, and after the memorial service, the CFMEU, the union, have a sausage sizzle out there after the memorial service, because the building industry's worked for a long time to lobby that asbestos isn't used. And I was standing out there eating a piece of white bread with a sausage.
It's a wonderfully Australian image. I can see you there with your white bread and your sausage outside the memorial service. Yes.
Yes, next to the Yarra River in Melbourne. And Ron was at the barbecue, and he had on an apron, and he had these barbecue tongs, and he was telling me, you know, about asbestos, and he was telling me about building a crematorium. And so he told me, waving these barbecue tongs around, said, look, I've built some of the best crematoriums in Australia, the Southern Hemisphere, possibly the world. And I'm very proud. And they were all, you know, there's a special brick technique you do for this, and it was lined with asbestos, and it was because of these crematoriums that he was exposed to asbestos. And he said, you know, but when I die, I want to be burned in this particular crematorium that he's very proud of, and he wants the lid off the coffin so that he can admire his brickwork as he burns.
That's fantastic. That's got everything that a theatre maker could want. It's got tragedy, it's got drama, it's got comedy, it's got a crematorium. No wonder you thought there was a theatre show in this, Donna.
Well, it was that moment that I thought, well, this is quite black humour, but it also, he had me engaged and I was laughing, but I was learning more about asbestos and I thought, well, that's the way I can make this show. If I can link into this idea of humour and charm and resilience, and while Ron was speaking, he was wheezing, I thought, I shouldn't be laughing, but I am. So that's how we made the show, and this idea of people with resilience and a sense of humour.
So it toured all around the place. If I'd gone to see it, what would have I experienced it if I was seeing Dust the Theatre Show before we get to Dust the book?
Dust the Theatre Show you would have seen in each local community that we did it. So say we did it in Brisbane at the Brisbane Powerhouse, and in Brisbane we engaged with local people from the community, 70 local people, and you would come into a stage area that had all little tents down the side. And at the start of the show, you could walk from sideshow to sideshow in a little tent and have different stories told to you about asbestos. And so in Brisbane, we linked up with primary school teachers and the teachers' union who were working at that time to get asbestos removed from primary schools. And so we could tell a real story in that little sideshow tent from Brisbane, as well as other sideshow tents where we had a magician using asbestos, talking about it being a magic product. And we also had another little tent where we had lawyers talking about some of the claims for compensation. So you could see in those little tents little stories. And then Mark Seymour would come on with a guitar and sing a song called Miss Micronite. And then we had a girl jumping out of a giant Kent cigarette box and doing a burlesque number.
So how did Mark Seymour get involved, Donna? Because he's gonna add something to any production.
I met Mark Seymour when we were doing the first show, We Built This City. And at that time he was interested, and he's still interested, in finding real Australian stories to base his songs on. And he's also interested in communicating big ideas. And so that works really well when we're trying to make theatre that's about social change. And I remember when we did We Built This City, I invited him down to under the Westgate Bridge, which is a place where 35 workers died when the bridge collapsed in 1970. And he was down there and he wrote a song, Westgate, to honour those 35 workers who died. And with this show, Dust, he did a whole lot of research. And he's interested in history. And so it's a partnership where he's helping me create important political theatre and I'm helping him find great ideas for songs. So I think that's a really good partnership.
Let's just hear a little bit from another song that Mark performed in Dust. This is Legend of the Snowman.
We're in the furnace, we're on the floor. I'm making payments on my club sport Commodore. 15 weeks from now, and she'll be mine. I'll take the big bucks home anytime. My jackhammer into the wall. Pretty soon, the dust is gonna fall. That old poison from long ago. She's the devil, you know. The devil, you know.
On Books and Arts, I'm Sarah Kanoski. I'm speaking with the theatre maker Donna Jackson about her production Dust, which looked at the history of asbestos in Australia and collaborated with Mark Seymour, who we heard there, such a distinctive voice, of course, from Hunters and Collectors. So, Donna, how does the book fit into to this project? You've done this huge show. It's toured around, really successful. Why then a book?
I did the book because during the process of making the show Dust, I linked up with five women who'd all lost their husbands to asbestos-related diseases. And the main person in that group is Nikki Hanslow. And I had lunch with a group of five women over a number of years who have lost their husbands. And I'd done seven seasons of this show and I was saying, oh, I'm not sure if I can do the last season in Melbourne. I'm really exhausted. And Nikki and also Lorraine Faulkner suggested that I turn the play into a book that could be used for schools. And I went, really? And I thought, wow. And they said, can't you make Dust into a show so that schools could perform it instead of doing Joseph and his Technicolor coat? It could be doing Dust, the musical. That's right. And I said, well, what a great idea. So I put the funding that I had from the Australia Council to make the theatre show, to make the book. And then I thought, with the book, I've got the play in there, but then I need to explain the process of working and my method of making theatre and working with large groups. And so that's gone into the book as well. And then in the book we've also included the recording of the songs by Mark Seymour. And then we had a documentary made with ABC called Making Dust by Malcolm McKinnon. We've put that in a USB in the book too.
So it's sort of like a huge resource from the way you're describing it there, that you want people to plunder in a good way for their own uses.
Yes, they might plunder it and use it as there's also lessons in there for drama teachers, and that links to asbestos in the show that drama teachers can use by Meg Upton. So it's I think for me, when I was a young theatre maker and I was trying to make political theatre, I was running around trying to learn how to do it, and I had to serve an apprenticeship with different people, and then I didn't have any reading material. So now this book, Art and Social Change, Dust, a Case Study, I hope that there's young practitioners who want to make interesting, large-scale, exciting theatre, and they'll use this as a textbook. So it's a gift to them, I think.
Well, it sounds hugely valuable, Donna. Congratulations. Thanks so much for coming on to Books and Arts to tell us about it.
Thanks, Sarah.
That's Donna Jackson. And if you want to have a look at the book, we'll put the details on our website and a link to Donna Jackson's website. Any drama teachers, you know, I think Donna's right. Let's kick out Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat and let's put Dust on instead. You're with Books and Arts on RN. And now I want you to take your corners for a battle over technology and language. If you can't write in the proper way, if you don't know how to conjugate, maybe you flunked that class, and maybe now you find that people mark you on line. What's your take on whether technologies such as Twitter and texting are degrading the English language? Does it matter that the 2015 Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year was an emoji? Well, this is the debate that Sticks and Stones is having at the Emerging Writers Festival. And arguing the pro-emoji case is Katie Keyes, a poet and writer and the director of Writers Victoria. Arguing for the anti-emoji side is Telia Neville, a writer, performer and photographer. And our moderator is Sky Kirkham. He began by asking Katie whether her language had been changed by technology.
Definitely. So for the last 7 years, I have written and tweeted a poem every day. So my creative practice has been ultimately and irrevocably changed by the practice of writing in 140 characters or less. And also by the routine, by setting the habit of having to produce something every day. So in the beginning, I was certainly writing and tweeting a pretty dreadful poem every day and finding it quite a challenge to hone it to the 140 character limit. But after nearly 7 years, I have a very large body of very small work and I now find it hard to think beyond those 140 character limit.
With those 140 characters, though, is that what you would see in a traditional poem, or is it the slimmed down and emoji-filled version that you might see?
It can be a combination of both, and obviously it's not the full 140 characters because I make the most of the technologies available to me to network with the incredibly broad and diverse online poetry community. So hashtag poetry, hashtag MPY for micropoetry, joining that international conversation around this exciting and emerging art form.
Telia?
I do use Twitter, yes. And I do enjoy it for the way it forces you to edit your thoughts in terms of sort of fitting more into less words. But I don't find that I alter my patterns or my rhythms too much. And I actually started to sort of do multi-tweet poems for a while and then thought, this isn't working. People are reading them in the reverse. So no, I haven't found it alter my language very much. Okay. I just get a little frustrated sometimes.
How important then is the platform? Is something like LOL okay in online chat? And is it okay outside of online chat? Are the words that we use online okay to use in other contexts? We'll go for the anti-emoji case first.
So I will put up with an LOL on a social media platform because I understand that it's come to mean more than laugh out loud, that it has subtleties that you learn as you use it more and as the community around you use it more, that lol means something different to ha-ha and ha-ha-ha and ha-ha-ha lol means something different again. So I'm all for nuance, go for it. But once you emerge back into the real, in real life, actual conversation world, lol is not okay. I would rather see you laugh or see you smirk or see the subtlety of your reaction on your face and in a physical reaction than hear you fall back on a description of a physical reaction.
I see, whereas I am a full-blown member of the LOLvolution. It's exciting. You know, the languages that we use on and off technology are a part of a continually evolving process. And the lull in particular, I think, is fascinating because the lull has gone from this hazy, from its introduction for Laugh Out Loud, to then this hazy middle ground as it's become mainstream through a process of misinterpretation. So there's that gorgeous story about someone's mum signing off with an lull to a news of a funeral announcement on Facebook because she thought it was lots of love and inadvertently caused a bit of offence until it was that mix-up was clarified. So I think we've come through that now to, as you say, this new nuanced meaning that has not only become virulent in the online space but is now coming back full circle into written speech, so that now, for example, it's so nuanced that if you do laugh out loud to something, you need to write in your tweet, "I actually lolled," but to get your meaning across.
I feel like that nuance is not necessarily a universally understood nuance, as demonstrated by our mother and her funeral lol. I mean, if you're looking for the meaning and sort of a range of possible nuances of most words, you'll look up the dictionary. But this kind of level of nuance and subtlety is something that you really only pick up if you're habitually on social media and if you're an early adopter and quick at picking up what's happening in the community around you. But if you're not, then it becomes this kind of, it's either an impenetrable wall of indecipherable gibberish, or it's a joke that you're not in on. It's a wall between you and the people who have sort of fully jumped into this pool, as opposed to you who are interested in that pool but only stuck your toes in at this point.
Is this then a generational shift? Because every generation has its own slang, its own almost impenetrable language from the outside. Is this kind of speech the modern equivalent of that?
Looking at Katie, I'm pretty sure we come from the same generation. We just come from using technology in different ways and in different levels of commitment. So I don't feel like it's stratified according to generation. It's absolutely stratified according to sort of subcultures as much as they exist now, which is barely at all. Now that anyone can sort of take from anything and build their own micro subculture in and of themselves. But yeah, I don't think it's stratified on age anymore. I think it's stratified on which platforms you're involved in, how much you're involved in them, how many times a day you check in, whether you're just using it as an information gathering tool or as a social networking tool or as a look at me tool. You know, it's the ways that you use it, how often you use it, which one you decided to use, whether you're an Instagram or a Twitter person or a Facebook, or you're still clinging with your bloodied fingernails to MySpace, you know?
I think I agree with you, Telly, that it's not necessarily a generational issue, but we differ on the reasons why. I mean, you mentioned slang, and it's always amusing to me that slang itself is slang for shortened language. This is not a new phenomenon. This is that, sure, technology is bringing us a whole new wave, but the evolution, the transmigration of language has been happening since we began speaking. And unless we're talking Esperanto, you know, we're not going to get a universally accepted language. We're talking, you know, this is text talk and emojis, is this the new Shakespeare? You know, is this the new generation of words in a pace that hasn't quite caught up with the world but will become the important cultural lexicon of the next decade's time?
If this was another layer of dirt in the history of language, if we were building on top of the early computer era that built on top of the sort of late printing press that built on top of the early printing press, if it was another layer of earth, then that would be absolutely fine. But it seems like we're letting all of the other layers erode and just having this layer of earth and thinking that's okay because we're still creating new language. We're just also at the same time allowing a whole range of older parts of language to sort of drift away with the seeds of time.
On Books and Art, we are debating, are technologies like Twitter and texting degrading the English language? It's part of the Sticks and Stones debate coming up at the Emerging Writers Festival. I am joined by Katie Keyes, arguing that, no, they're not degrading it, they're adding things. And Tillia Neville, who is arguing that, no, it is degrading language. Gosh darn it. Katie, you mentioned the classics? Could this be our next generation Shakespeare? I note that you can actually buy YOLO Juliet. You can buy Emoji Dick. There have been versions of classic texts updated to this sort of speech. Is that a good thing? Are we bringing more people in to the text that they wouldn't read otherwise, or is it destroying the heart of the text?
I think it's fascinating. I'm not necessarily as interested in those texts as texts themselves, as a new interpretation of the entire YOLO Juliet, but as an academic exercise, in the same way that in academia all the way across Australia, poets and writers are pushing the boundaries of language, experimenting in a way that may not, the final project is perhaps more of an experiment than finished to complete text, in the same way that the runways of Fashion Week are haute couture examples that trickle down into further language. So while a fully full Romeo and Juliet in Emojis may not be a penetrable, enjoyable text for everybody, the ideas behind it are so stimulating and so exciting. And, you know, not the impenetrable wall of gibberish that Tilia referred to earlier, but like poetry, pushing the bounds of what it means to communicate.
As a high school kid, you get handed a Shakespeare text, and a well-meaning teacher will often ask you to convert it into your frames of speech so that you can understand it better, so that you can sort of really dig down underneath the beautiful, lyrical, admittedly sometimes overly flowery turns of phrase to find the meaning that lies underneath. And if YOLO Juliet was one kid's school project, really drilling down into Romeo and Juliet and trying to understand exactly what was happening in a bare bones structure during Romeo and Juliet, that would be one thing. But the thing about doing that is that that's a fantastic exercise in learning how to really seek the base level meaning, so that then you can put the words back on and really feel how they clothe these basic sentiments in couture outfits. But if you go with the basic skeletal elements and say, this is Shakespeare, it's just Shakespeare for the modern age, it's stripping away so much beauty and wit and subtlety. Two pages of YOLO Juliet cover almost three scenes. It's astonishing. The party scene goes for about a page and a half.
But are we talking about this being as a replacement for these classical texts when they're not? They're adding intertextuality. They're adding a whole new way of interpreting whilst not taking away from anything we have before. The change is happening at such an an exponential pace that we are getting more and more means and icons and ways of communication while that add value and new context and new cultural significance to what's come before, not
but
replacing it.
The word interpreting implies a level of sort of understanding, assimilating, and then feeding back with new insight. And YOLO Juliet just does not do that.
The 2015 Oxford Word of the Year was an emoji. Does the Oxford Word of the Year matter to anyone not currently sitting in a radio studio?
Well, I think that the very fact that they made their Word of the Year an emoji was a really bold act. It's also a very clear reflection that they have their finger on the pulse of language. They were recognising an international trend. And the furor that it caused certainly is testament to the fact that people do care either one way or the other.
I think it legitimised the use of emojis. It acknowledged it as, you know, a new actual part of language, not a passing phase, not something that's going to come and go as quickly as MySpace. And I love the fact that it caused a furor. I love the fact that people got angry on both sides and came out fighting to defend their side, because that's what needs to happen right now. It can't just be an acceptance of what's changing in language and allowing things to sort of sweep us away. It has to be constantly examining what's happening. And these arguments between people who are passionate about language can only benefit us all.
Telia Neville arguing the anti-emoji case, and Katie Keys took the pro-emoji side. I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of this. You can let us know at Twitter, Facebook, on our website, or you can send us a letter in iambic pentameter if that's your preference. If you're in Melbourne, you can see the full Sticks and Stones debate on Tuesday, June the 21st, at the TOFF in town, part of the Emerging Writers Festival, which is on now. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and on Books and Arts, we're now going emoji-free in medieval England with Simon Armitage. Simon Armitage was born in West Yorkshire, and that distinctive accent shapes his poetry. He is one of Britain's most read living poets and is currently Professor of Poetry at Oxford University. Simon is also a celebrated walker, as recounted in his best-selling memoirs All Points North, Walking Home and Walking Away. But recently he's been translating the classics of Middle English, first Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and now another work by that same anonymous medieval author. This one is called Pearl. Welcome to Books and Art, Simon Armitage. Could we begin with a reading from Pearl?
Well, shall I? I'll read the first stanza, because I think that gives a real sense of the where and the when and the how of the whole poem. Beautiful pearl that would please a prince, fit to be mounted in finest gold. I say for certain that in all the East her precious equal I never found. So radiant and round, however revealed, so small, her skin so very smooth, of all the gems I judged and prized, I set her apart, unparalleled. But I lost my pearl in a garden of herbs. She slipped from me through grass to ground, and I mourn now, with a broken heart, for that priceless pearl without a spot.
Simon Armitage reading from his translation of the medieval poem Pearl. It's just been published by Faber and Faber. Simon, what's the pleasure for you as a poet of translating these works?
I think there are a number of issues. One is that for the very first time in my life, I can speak and read another language, albeit one that's obsolete. So this is Middle English from the medieval period. I mean, some people claim that I don't even speak English, but suddenly I have this other facility to play with. And all poets know that you can't write poetry all the time. You just can't exist at that pitch, you can't attend with that level of concentration. But to be able to work on a translation where a lot of the anxieties of writing your own work are taken away, you know, you don't have to worry about how to begin it, how to end it, or what to put in the middle, that's all laid out. So whether you're in the mood or not, you can just pick it up and get on with it. And I think the other thing is that there aren't that many of us, and in harmonizing with voices from the past, I think there's a sense of genealogy that you're almost tracing ancestors. You're looking into what other like-minded people did, 600 years ago. So there's a feeling of connecting with roots and with lineage and with family.
So, I mean, you say that you now speak another language. I mean, how different is the language of this poem from modern English?
Well, if you think about Chaucer, who would have been a direct contemporary of the Gawain poet, or the Pearl poet, as we call them, you can pretty much read Chaucer off the page. You know, there will be occasional words that need glossing and occasional sentences that need glossing, but by and large, you can stumble through it. Pearl and Gawain is the same period, but it's sort of one step removed, really. Chaucer's English became the English that we speak now. But this would be, I suppose you could describe it as a dialect of the day, a northern or a midlands dialect of the day. So you'll be able to look at the original, some words, even some lines, you could read and you could make sense, and others would probably look more like Old English to you, like something out of Tolkien, that the dwarves might speak, and you would struggle. And I've sometimes described this period of Middle English language from this part of the world as being like our English, but under a layer of frosting. And the trick is to try and just breathe a little bit of warm air onto it to thaw it out and bring the words through.
This this poet and the language that this poem is written in is closer to the part of England that you're from than London. Does that allow you to have a different sort of resonance with the language, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why I became very interested and then very attached to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was because when I started looking at the original language, I recognised words there, words like nobbet and bairn and lake, which is a word that we use for play. If you're laking around, you're playing around. And
what does nobbet mean? Nobbet bairn is means, baby, but yeah, what's a nobbet?
It's nothing but. So it's a sort of contraction of those two words, and it's still in use in West Yorkshire. And although West Yorkshire isn't exactly the sort of epicentre of this language, it's only across the other side of the hill, across the Peak District. So, yeah, I think there was definitely sense for me of wanting to make contact with somebody local, and also with both these poems. I mean, this is probably more of a superstitious thing than a scientific or linguistic one, but just the idea of bringing these poems home a little bit, you know, especially with Gawain, it's become such a plaything of academics, and all those scholarly restorations are absolutely necessary. But every time you base a translation around faithful and you know, translations of words, you start taking it away from the music. And I wanted to try and, you know, reorchestrate the poems.
Well, let's take a closer look at Pearl. Tell me, what's this poem about?
It's what's often described as a dream vision poem. So a dreamer, a man, falls asleep in what he describes as a herb garden, and he is thinking about his pearl, who has become lost to him. And at this point, early on in the poem, the pearl seems to be both a precious stone and a precious person, a child. And he falls asleep and he begins to dream, and in his dream he enters this incredibly beautiful landscape, and he's standing at the side of a river, and when he looks up, she has appeared to him on the other side of the river, this vision of shining white beauty. And you know, you start to realize that this was his child, and that she died, and he is a bereaved parent. And they start having a conversation across the river, a conversation of, I suppose, consolation, really, and that she's trying to console him with the idea that she's now in heaven, which he finds incredulous, because we find out a little later in the poem that she was only two when she died. So it's a very upsetting poem, actually, in lots of ways, especially, you know, to, you know, I am the father of one child who is a daughter. And you know, you start very much to, you know, think about the, well, certainly about the autobiographical implications of the original poem, and the sense that this was somebody writing about their own bereavement and about their own loss.
And there's a second bereavement that happens through this poem, because there's this wonderful moment of reconnection between the father and the daughter, but then it's snatched away from him at the end of the poem.
Yeah, one of the things I think that makes the poem very real, even though it sounds contradictory, is the dream itself, because we've all had those dreams where in the dream something incredibly wonderful happens to us. You know, we win the lottery, or you know, we inherit a sort of an ocean-going yacht or something, and then, you know, then we wake up and it's not true. And at the very moment where he experiences this great wave of ecstasy and wants to rush across the river to join her and to be with her in heaven and to be reunited with his lost child, he rushes forward, and of course he wakes up, and so all that elation that he's felt has been misplaced, and it's a really devastating moment. I think there's a sense in the poem that he's supposed to have been consoled by what she's told him, and yet there's still a sense that he wakes up with still, you know, an extraordinary sense of loss and regret.
On Books and Arts, I'm Sarah Kanoski, and I'm speaking with the poet Simon Armitage about his new work, which is a translation of a Middle English poem called Pearl. As you say, Simon, the father is sort of incredulous about the afterlife fate of his daughter, not just because of her age, but also it's sort of this wonderful impression that he has that they're sort of, she's too lowly to be a queen of heaven, you know, that surely she should be like, maybe the most she could be is a lady or a sort of a noble woman, but this queen surely is beyond what could have been expected in their station in life.
I think this is one of the things that makes the poem more interesting than something which otherwise would have been just Christian dogma and doctrine. I think in a regulation church poem, she would have spelt out the rules and the system of faith, and he would have accepted them, and he would have gone away, a more fervent believer. But he is, slightly bewildered by the claims that she's making. As he points out, she was only 2 when she died. She hadn't really learned how to pray or to pay proper attention to God. And yet he's served his time on earth. He's been full of faith and he's very devout. Why should she be sitting there at the side of Christ, one of his brides? They don't quite have a barney about it, but there's a little bit of bickering going on between the two. And towards the end of the poem, I feel as if she hasn't quite persuaded him. So she shows him a glimpse of the heavenly Jerusalem, the shining citadel. And it's as if, what she's realized, if she can't persuade him through argument, the way to a man's heart is through architecture. And so she gives him this little glimpse of paradise on the other side of the river. And of course, he's overwhelmed by it.
And it's got, there's some wonderful detail and sort of specificity in these sections of the poem, which is where I think I kind of connected to it most. There's a description where he has this vision of, I think it's 144,000 virgin brides that the Lamb of Christ has. But then the narrator says, and they didn't even elbow one another, although there were so many of them massing there together. Yeah. No one pushed each other out of the way. It's a beautiful little human detail in this very otherworldly image.
It's a gorgeous human detail, and it's inserted into the middle of a section that's lifted almost verbatim from Book of Revelation. There are all kinds of quotes from the Bible scattered all the way through the poem, but as we get towards the end, there are great chunks of Revelation, and it's as if he is witnessing what was actually written down in the Bible. But as you say, those moments where he identifies for himself little details, that's what makes it such a wonderfully authored piece, rather than just a cribbed piece of biblical material. This poet knows that God is in the detail.
What about the structure of the poem, Simon? It sounds like it's quite a complicated structure, very tied to the language of Middle English. How did you go about that aspect of the translation?
Yeah, it's incredibly ornate and sort of lapidary and crystalline. I suppose to, reflect the nature of the pearl stone itself. And there's this number symbolism which recurs all the way through the poem, particularly over the number 12. 12 lines per verse, a total of 1,212 lines in the whole poem. And I think that's to reflect the size of heavenly Jerusalem, which I think in the Book of Revelations is 12 furlongs by 12 furlongs. Gosh. And then the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 gates of of paradise and so on and so forth.
We're getting very Masonic here, Simon, in this detail.
Getting all a bit Dan Brown, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose that's one of the things you're having to grapple with when you're translating. It's not just, in this case, from one language to another. It's from one time period and from one mindset, one theology to another.
Yeah, that's right. And I think because, you know, we don't know and probably never will know who the author was, we'll never really know exactly what the purpose of the poem was. And I think those absences allow for a little latitude when you're translating to, you know, to, especially if you're translating as a poet, to push the poem in particular directions. But this is a poem which works beautifully well on the surface and at the end of the day is describing, you know, even now, you know, a contemporary human situation which is the loss of a loved one, and that, you know, unfortunately is never an outdated idea.
Has translating these works had an effect on your own poetic imagination, on your own poetic language, do you think?
I think it's probably expanded the horizons and the possibilities of that. I would argue that it would take an outside eye to judge the directions that it's taken them in. You know, it might even take a psychologist to work out how my own writing's been affected. I know when I'd finished translating Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, I realised that even before I spoke, I was trying to formulate sentences that had three or four alliterating stressed syllables in them to become a kind of Tourette's. And I had to sort of take some time off from alliteration and write some poems that had no rules to them whatsoever, that just went all over the place and did whatever they wanted to do.
And I think, as you said earlier, that there's a link from a poet being able to go back to this earlier, if unknown, poet and sort of pay homage to them through reimagining the words. There's that gift for the reader as well, to think that we're reading something that people read hundreds and hundreds of years ago. That's a very powerful gift too.
Yeah, I was reading from the poem at the Aeon Y Festival last week, and it suddenly occurred to me, you know, there I was in the middle of this field in a marquee, reading a poem that, you know, my guess is that the poet at the time would have no idea that their work would have, you know, remained in existence or still be alive in some way. And I got an incredible thrill out of that. I mean, you know, most poems are only read once, and that's by the author. so for something to lay dormant for hundreds of years and then to have another life is an incredible thing.
Well, centuries from now, there'll be someone reading Simon Armitage in a tent, I'm sure.
Well, we won't be around to disprove or prove that, will we?
Simon, yeah. Thanks so much for being my guest. Pleasure. On Books and Arts.
The Classic 100 Voice, music that makes your heart sing. Own the 8-CD box set now, featuring all 100 of Australia's favourite works from opera, song and choral music, including Ode to Joy, The Flower Duet, Zadok the Priest, Carmina Burana and much more. The Classic 100 Voice, out now from ABC Shop Online, ABC Centres, all good music stores and for download.
You're with Books and Arts on RN, and if you're interested in reading that Simon Armitage translation of Pearl, it's published by Faber and Faber. Now on Books and Arts, it's time for Top Shelf, and today we're hearing from the winner of this year's Vogel Literary Award. The Vogel, of course, is Australia's most prestigious prize for an unpublished manuscript from a writer under the age of 35. Catherine Braeburn won the 2016 prize for her debut novel, The Memory Artist. It's set in Russia and it follows a man called Pasha Isinov, the son of dissidents, who is struggling in his attempt to record the horrors of Stalin's rule.
My name is Catherine Braeburn. My debut novel is now out, called The Memory Artist. And here are five works of art that have influenced me in some way. The first is W.G. Zabel's novel Austerlitz. I read this a few months after I started writing my novel, and it made me want to, in some ways, stop writing, but also to keep trying to write to achieve something like that. He writes about a man who is traumatised by his experience of losing his parents in the Holocaust, but it's an act of kind of attempting to remember and find some kind of understanding through remembering and imagining and reading and walking. And it's a really powerful book, and it really kind of changed my idea of how you can possibly represent history in a book. Another novel is José Saramago's The Year of the Death of Ricardo Reis. It was the last thing I read before I started writing myself, and it really challenged me about to think of what you can do with a novel. It wasn't afraid to be complicated and ideas driven. It was beautiful and sad and funny and deep and clever all at once. And it has stayed with me as a favourite book. And I often return to it just to read certain passages. It's, yeah, one that I haven't really quite forgotten about. Another work of, this was a work of visual art, is Picasso's Guernica painting. I saw it in Spain about 5 years ago, and I read that it was thought to be a response or a representation of the Civil War. And to me, I'm trying to, in my work, write about things that are sometimes so traumatic that they're beyond expression. And this painting feels like such a pained and bewildered response to trauma. It's enormous. It's sort of has a skewed perspective. You don't know where the centre is. You don't know what events are starting or what is over. To me, it's a real kind of work of trauma. It's a work that confronts you and shocks you. And I thought it was so powerful, and I've often thought about it in the years since. A work of music, a work of art that I have listened to a lot is Bon Iver's album Bon Iver, Bon Iver. And I started listening to it a lot when I was living overseas, and it was a very kind of lonely cold winter when it was just a few of us sort of living in Oxford after everyone else had gone home for the winter holidays. And every song is the name of a place, and I felt like every song had a real sense of kind of place, but also strange kind of sense of memory and longing, and almost kind of coloured in a way, in a really beautiful way. And it's an album I've really liked listening to again, and it always brings me back to that particular time in my life. And it's one I know that I'll always enjoy listening to, just because I'm amazed by what he can kind of create through a song, really create a place in a song that could make me feel somehow nostalgic for something that I'm not quite sure. And it's a real, real incredible experience. It's just so artful to listen to. And the last thing that I would like to talk about is two statues in St. Petersburg. They were made by an artist, Mikhail Chemyakin, and he fled the Soviet Union in the early 70s because his works were not conforming to the regimes. So he's made these two statues of sphinxes on an embankment in St. Petersburg, and they face each other. And what's really striking about them is that they're these emaciated bodies of half sphinx, half skeleton, and they're a monument to victims of political repression in the Soviet Union. And it's interesting that the embankment faces a prison where in the early Soviet system a lot of political prisoners were held. And to me, it's just a really powerful kind of haunting expression and commemoration. And I went to see them when I went to St. Petersburg last year, and I took a lot of photos, and I still look at them as kind of a reminder of the things that I've studied and the things that I've written about in my own novel. And they're really, really powerful.
Catherine Brabham with her Top Shelf, and Catherine's debut novel, The Memory Artist, is published by Allen and Unwin. It was the winner of this year's Vogel Prize. Thanks so much for your company on Books and Arts today, and a big thanks to the Books and Arts team this week. Executive producer Michelle Rayner, producers Anna Frey-Taylor, Claire Nichols, Fiona Gruber, Kate Evans, Georgia Moody and Michael Cathcart. Georgia and Michael were in Hobart earlier this week for Dark Mofo. If you missed that, have a look at our website and you can listen to that story or any of our stories again. Download or pod absolutely free. I'm Sarah Kanoski. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 2 for the best of the last week of Books and Arts. I hope you can join me then.